The meat inside the pyramid is almost hermetically sealed from the outside. As with vacuum wraps, bacteria cannot enter. But why does the meat dry out? What is drawing out the juices? Check patent number 93304. Similar thoughts must have crossed the mind of the Czech radio engineer Karel Drbal, who read about Monsieur Bovee's experiments in an obscure magazine. Drbal reproduced Bovee's experiments and found that the results were the same, but he felt that meat, eggs, and cheese were the wrong ingredients in these pyramid experiments. How about inorganic, non-living substances? Could a rock, a spoon, or a thimble of water be dehydrated in a model pyramid? Karel Drbal looked for a small object which would fit in his tiny 8-centimeter-high cardboard pyramid, baseline 12.5 centimeters. He happened upon an old razor blade whose life had extended beyond all usefulness. The radio engineer suspected that the blade would lose its last spark of sharpness inside the pyramid. 24 hours later, he examined it under a magnifying glass. Was he hallucinating, or did the blade indeed look as if it had been sharpened? Without a moment's hesitation, Karel Drbal shaved off his beard stubbles with the old blade. Then he returned the razor to the pyramid. He figured that there had to be some way to finish off the wafer-thin metal. But the next day, he got a perfect shave again from the old blade. What was happening? Was it a figment of his imagination, or was the blade getting sharper every day? He slowly stroked his smoothly shaved chin, which showed no trace of even the tiniest cut. Amazed, Drbal returned the blade to the pyramid and continued to shave with it without incident for 50 full days. All of this happened in February and March of 1949. The radio engineer tenaciously continued experimenting for another 5 years and 3 months, until July 6, 1954, averaging 105 daily shaves with each blade. Overall, Drbal used 18 different blades from various manufacturers. The final number of shaves accomplished with one blade ranged from 100 to 200 with daily use. Karel Drbal continued to use his free razor sharpener even after the termination of his experiments. Over a period of 25 years, he only needed an amazingly few 28 razor blades. Understandably, razor manufacturers were less than thrilled about his findings. The next stop, obviously, was to apply for a patent. But how? Karel Drbal had no idea what process was responsible for the goings-on inside the model pyramid. He applied for a patent anyway. And because he knew that the patent committee was hardly going to be convinced, he presented the metallurgist on the committee with a small, complimentary pyramid containing a razor blade. The metallurgist, though skeptical, tried the pyramid blade on his own beard. In the summer of 1959, Karel Drbal was granted a patent for a device to maintain the sharpness of razor blades and razor knives. Check patent number 93304. Since then, the razor blade experiment has been repeated thousands of times with identical results. As long as the model pyramid and the cutting edge of the razor blade have been oriented precisely in a north-south direction. In his TV program, Terra X, Dr. Gottfried Kirchner reported on a strictly scientific experiment conducted by Professor J. Eichmeier of the Technical University of Munich. As part of the experiment, half of a razor blade was placed in a plexiglass pyramid for 8 days, the other half in a closed drawer. Both halves were then examined under a surface electron microscope. According to Dr. Kirchner, the differences in the width of the cutting edge, as well as in the surface structures of the two blade halves, were significant. To explain the incomprehensible, what force affects the molecular structure and thus the composition of atoms in a steel blade? Why does the experiment only work with a pyramid, but not with a cube or a cylinder? What is so special about the pyramid shape, and why does the mysterious energy flow only if the pyramid is oriented in a north-south direction? By now, it is indisputable that changes occur not only in steel, but in other materials as well. Yet no one has a satisfactory explanation for this phenomenon. Dr. Kirchner refers to American scientists who believe that the radiation energy of the objects is being contained inside the pyramid. The energy cannot escape through the side walls, but instead is reflected inside the pyramid. The constant reflections, according to this theory, change the structure. At first glance, this may sound sensible, and yet it raises more questions than it answers. Every molecular compound, i.e., all matter, radiates. Radio astronomers were able to prove the existence of many organic and inorganic substances in space solely based on the radiation emanating from them. Radiation also means loss of energy. If a radiation source expended all of its energy, it would cease to exist. In the subatomic range, the lost energy is constantly replenished because electrons, as the components of the atom, alter their state and in essence jump from one energy level to the next. It is just as easy for an electron to slip through the cardboard wall of a pyramid as it is for air to pass through the mesh of a fishing net. How could the angle of inclination of a pyramid possibly interfere with that? Carl Durbal identifies a number of different reasons for the pyramid effect. So-called dipolar water molecules are stored in the tiny crevices of the crystalline structure of the razor blade edge. The resonance of the radiation energy forces them out of their hiding spots. Symbolically, according to Durbal, the process could be called the dehydration of the razor blade edge. Where do these dipolar water molecules magically disappear to? After all, they are supposed to be reflected by the inside of the pyramid. Durbal maintains that they attach themselves to the air surrounding them, which, in all likelihood, is the only possible solution. The experimental pyramids are air permeable. But what happens if the pyramid forms a vacuum that does not allow air to enter or exit the pyramid? What measurable forces are necessary to eject or release the dipolar water molecules from the steel? The Soviet physicist Malinov cited electromagnetic waves in connection with the magnetic fields of the Earth for the curious pyramid effect. But why, for the sake of old pyramid-building pharaohs, do these waves kill mold and decay, producing fungi and bacteria in food, while at the same time preserving the foods and even enhancing their natural flavor? The Ancient Astronaut Society, a nonprofit organization dealing with my theories, wanted to find out more and encourage its members to conduct pyramid experiments with all kinds of different materials. Over the course of several weeks and months, it received 118 reports from men and women with various professional backgrounds and from students. All of them had crafted model pyramids of various sizes from a variety of materials, had stored them in gardens, basements, attics, bedrooms, on an air mattress, anchored in a swimming pool, and even in a refrigerator, and had equipped them with the most amazing objects. One 16-year-old boy from Holzkirchen in Bavaria reported that he had placed ants in a small plastic box and that they had died after 4 days. Another 16-year-old described his experiment with flies, which died after 24 hours. Obviously, the poor creatures lacked oxygen, liquids, and food. I immediately called the young scientist to tell them to terminate their horrifying experiments at once. A female teacher who was vacationing in Ticino, the southernmost canton of Switzerland, placed a piece of slightly moldy bread inside her pyramid, which was covered with wax paper. She then deposited her pyramid, 22 centimeters high, in the basement because it is so humid there, and mold fungi love humidity and darkness. 18 days later, the mold was gone. The bread crumbled into tiny morsels. Pow! A retiree from Arbonne, on the shores of Lake Constance, got a surprise when he placed a flat, round candle, the type that is used in potpourri burners, inside a glass pyramid. He reported that he merely wanted to see if the flame would burn steadily. The flame, however, kept going out because of a lack of oxygen, and the 68-year-old man lost interest. He forgot all about the pyramid sitting on the bookshelf. 9 days later, he peered into the pyramid in passing and saw that the candle had turned into a crippled wax finger. The deformation of the candle could not have been caused by the moderate fall temperatures, and none of the other candles in the room were affected in any way. Mrs. Elke, a 26-year-old amateur painter from Wuppertal, Germany, was similarly astounded. She enjoys creating miniature oil paintings a mere 5 centimeters wide. After completing one of her pictures, she positioned it on a delicate pedestal inside a 28-centimeter-high glass pyramid. She was not interested in an experiment. Rather, she felt that the miniature picture, which showed a small house, a cat, and a full moon, looked particularly pretty behind the triangular glass walls of the pyramid. 1 week later, Mrs. Elke thought that the painting had changed. 3 weeks later, the moon had dripped from the sky. The paint of the dark brown wooden roof had become crusty. The dark blue sky had a brilliant shine, and the end of the cat's tail had disappeared. Great special effect. I recommended that Mrs. Elke try to sell her future creations as genuine pyramid paintings. Another pyramid experiment conducted by Mr. and Mrs. Bergmuller in Hamburg, Germany, involved the use of ordinary honey. The Bergmullers, who live on the 8th floor of a high-rise building, bought a small plexiglass pyramid only 14.5 centimeters high. One day after breakfast, Mr. Bergmuller measured 2 teaspoons of honey into a bowl, which he placed on a podium inside the pyramid. 24 days later, the honey had hardened into a solid lump which felt like stiff wax. Then, inadvertently, Mrs. Bergmuller moved the pyramid out of its north-south direction when she was cleaning the living room. Presto! 6 days later, the honey was running from the bowl again. Maybe this could explain the tears of St. Januarius in the Cathedral of Napoli, which magically began to flow every year. These rather haphazard results have been confirmed by more scientific experiments. Some quiet and friendly individuals scrupulously document their experiments and even weigh their objects on letter scales. Gerhard Leiner of Graz, Austria, constructed a model pyramid from particle board, 4.5 millimeters thick. He began his experiments on March 19, 1983, at 12:30. Inside the north-south-oriented pyramid was a 7-day-old chicken egg, weighing 60.2 grams. A second egg was kept outside the pyramid. The room in which the experiment took place had an average temperature of 19 degrees Celsius. On October 4th, 200 days later, the egg inside the pyramid had lost 58.8% of its weight, but the yolk was yellow, the smell was normal, and the egg was edible. The control egg outside the pyramid, on the other hand, was reeking to high heavens, or to the room ceiling anyway. Leiner conducted other long-term experiments which confirmed the earlier results. However, none of the eggs have hatched so far. Other members of the Ancient Astronaut Society experimented with apple slices, radishes, flower seeds, tobacco, orange juice, cucumber, and tomato plants, even strawberries. The experimenters agreed unanimously that all the fruits inside the pyramid acquired a stronger taste. Vegetables under a foil-covered greenhouse pyramid grew faster than control plants. Cucumbers and tomatoes were firmer, denser, and had a much more concentrated aroma than any control group of vegetables. Magic? hocus pocus, fraud, or an overactive imagination. Imagination is the only weapon in the war against reality, it is true. But it is not a factor in these experiments. The objects in the experiments changed measurably and visibly. The scientific method requires that results be reproducible at any given time. Well, they are, although no one knows what is really happening or why. Some friends of mine gave me a glass pyramid as a gift. It sat around the porch, a winter garden of sorts, for several weeks. One night I had some Bordeaux wine that had not been properly aged. I admit, I enjoy having a glass of Bordeaux occasionally. In time, the palate, the tongue, and the stomach can tell whether a wine flows smoothly, whether it is of good quality, whether it soothes the stomach and spreads like divine nectar through one's body. This Bordeaux was wild, raw, and sour. It had not matured. While I was pouring the wine into a vinegar bottle, I was possessed by the pyramid spirit, which made me do something very strange. I took another Bordeaux of the same brand and placed it inside my glass pyramid and forgot about it. Autumn and winter came and went. In the spring, I, the emancipated husband, helped my wife straighten up the porch. There was the wine bottle. The color of the Bordeaux had become darker. It tasted full-bodied, silky, non-acidic, like a 7-year-old Grand Cru Classé. The expert knows what this means. I set up a taste test with a second bottle of the same vintage, which had been sitting in the cellar. The difference was striking. Regular guests to my house can attest to the fact that ever since that day, I have kept a bottle of Bordeaux under my pyramid for several occasions. Suggestions for possibilities. Pyramid numbers and pyramid forces, they exist, yet no university attempts to understand them. Shouldn't immunologists and hygienists be forced to find out why certain bacteria, viruses, and fungi perish inside the pyramid while others do not? Does the pyramid shape alter poisons that are difficult to dispose of? Does it harden alloys or welding joints? Can pyramids improve the effectiveness of crude oil or other naturally occurring chemicals, enhance the flavor of spices, or even clean pool water without chlorine? Can pyramids be used as water treatment plants, as freshwater storage tanks? Would it be possible to age wine by the barrel inside a pyramid, preserve fresh vegetables, flowers, and fruits? As a world traveler, I know firsthand how quickly medicines spoil in third world countries because refrigerators either are not available or are not functioning. Why hasn't it occurred to any of the huge chemical concerns to try pyramid packaging? I am merely jotting down some spontaneous questions. Thoughts have effects. Maybe one of my ideas will stimulate some alert mind. It would be a shame to let the pyramid powers go to waste just because they carry the slight stigma of obscurity. After all, the most bothersome fact about these pyramid phenomena is their proven existence. How often have spontaneous utterances produced great things? So, I am letting my thoughts flow freely, that they may inspire greater glory. Do you feel drained, tired, depressed? Lie down inside a pyramid for a couple of hours so that your head rests in the lower third of the pyramid. You will notice with astonishment how the neurons in your burnt-out brain are starting to rejuvenate. However, be careful not to prolong the effect indefinitely. The pyramid effect is known to shrink waterheads. Are you unable to solve a particularly sticky problem? Are you searching for a truly exceptional idea? An overwhelming inspiration? The magic of the pyramid can do the trick. I have experienced it myself with great amazement. For decades, radio astronomers have been attempting to make contact with extraterrestrial life forms in outer space. So far, they have been unsuccessful, because their means and the wavelengths they've employed have been limited. Radio astronomy is based on electromagnetic waves. What else? Because radio waves travel 300,000 kilometers per second and thus are the fastest means of communication, fast in earthly terms, but not fast enough in universal terms. Talking to extraterrestrials in a solar system 20 light years from here would be very boring. It would take at least 40 years before the answers to our burning questions would reach our antennas. Isn't there anything faster than radio or light waves? Is the pyramid shape a transmitter to the universe, our ear to the extraterrestrials? Do the magnetic forces of the Earth enhance our thoughts inside a correctly positioned pyramid? Do people who pray send out thought patterns with praises and wishes to an eternal creator via a resonance floor in a church or temple? Can the powers of the pyramid transform human thoughts into impulses that travel faster than the speed of light? Are extraterrestrial telepathists in space pyramids waiting out there for our messages? Would you like to be a time traveler? Would you like to be carried away by the wave of time into the past or future? Would you like to progress just once to a different dimension and meet alien beings? Paul Brunton, a historian, spent a night inside the Great Pyramid and reports that wondrous things happened there. He describes the climax of that night when gigantic monsters, horrible images from the underworld, figures with grotesque, crazy, terrifying, devilish looks surrounded him and filled him with extreme disgust. In the span of a few minutes, he experienced something that he says is etched into his memory like a photograph. In the course of the night, Paul Brunton had contact with the high priests of an ancient Egyptian cult and was transformed into a spiritual being and led to the teaching hall. He was told that the pyramid stores the memory of lost tribes and the covenant, which the Creator made with the first great prophet. Brunton even maintains that the spirits led him into a hall deep below the pyramid. Does or did the Great Pyramid serve as a storage place for documents of ancient cultures? Are there any chambers and passageways that have not been explored? At what time in human history was this time capsule supposedly created? Does this hall Paul Brunton described deep below the pyramid actually exist? It does. I have been there. 4. The Eyes of the Sphinx. I simply picked a bunch of flowers and added nothing but the thread that binds them. Michel de Montaigne, French writer, 1533 to 1592. It is the beginning of December, 1988. The plateau of Giza is deserted. No tourist buses, no honking, no jostling, no camels, horses, or pesky vendors. No lines in front of the entrance to the Great Pyramid. The streets and paths between the ancient buildings are swept clean like the famous Bahnhofstrasse in Zurich. Schoolchildren are playing outside, irreverently bouncing their balls off the pyramid stones. Two serious-looking guards are blocking the entrance to Khufu's world wonder. They let no one pass, not even individual tourists who may appear at their gate. But no one is coming. What is happening in Giza? Are foreigners no longer welcome? A friendly inspector explains that the Grand Gallery is being restored. All travel agents and hotels have been informed, and so the tourists are not even brought out to Giza. Egypt has an endless number of splendid temples to offer instead, and the pyramids at Saqqara amply compensate visitors for missing out on Giza. My companion, Rudolf Eckart, a superb amateur photographer, and I introduced ourselves to the young inspector and politely asked him to make an exception in our case. We told him truthfully that we would appreciate the opportunity to take some pictures inside the Great Pyramid without the usual hustle and bustle of tourists. The man invited us into the Egyptologist's office. Several students and inspectors were sitting around on an old couch and some chairs. They patiently listened to my plea and took turns scrutinizing my identification papers, stealing furtive glances at our camera equipment. "Video? Film?" asked the chief of the group. "No," I answered, smiling reassuringly. "Just pictures." They offered us sweet black tea, and I handed out some chocolate from Switzerland. We talked shop for a while. I was glad that I had read so much about Egypt in the past few years. Then the chief asked one of the students to accompany us. We marched over to the Great Pyramid. The student asked us kindly if we needed any assistance. "No," I replied. "We are familiar with all the pertinent literature about the pyramid. We would just like to take some pictures without being interrupted by tourists." In front of the steps to the pyramid entrance, our student companion met two colleagues. They exchanged greetings. I told the student that he could wait there, and that we would take the pictures and then return to this spot. He nodded and called out some orders to the guards at the entrance. "Salam." They bowed modestly and let us in. A vault in the rock. Immediately upon entering, we noticed that the path to the ascending corridor was not the one along which tourists are generally admitted. A gently winding tunnel, broken out of some stone blocks, led us inside. As with any other visit, I was forced to stoop as I pulled myself up to the grand gallery, with the help of wooden handles secured to the walls. What a sight! The pyramid had not seen anything like this in 4,500 years. The whole gallery was stuffed with metal scaffolding and boards. We could not see any of the details which we had come to photograph. So we were happy to observe that at least the gate to the Queen's Chamber, which is usually shut, was standing open. But it offered the same sight, scaffolds, boards, and ladders. We turned around and walked back to the so-called three-way crossing, the point at which the ascending and descending corridors intersect with the entrance tunnel. Light bulbs spread a gentle, constant light. The gate leading to the corridor, which descends deep below the pyramid, was open as well. I peered down into the seemingly endless shaft. Gradually, the lights along the walls grew fainter as they disappeared into the gaping abyss. I had read about the subterranean sepulchre at the bottom of the pyramid. The inspectors rarely grant one permission to visit the vault. They say that the climb is too strenuous and too dangerous. Now we were standing in front of the entrance to the tunnel, and there was not a guard in sight. On the contrary, two guards were outside the pyramid entrance, barring anyone else from entering the pyramid. We called out a few times, "Hello? Is anybody there?" But only our own voices echoed from the walls. We were alone inside the pyramid. The shaft measured 1.2 by 1.06 meters, not high enough to allow one to stand upright, yet high enough that crawling wasn't necessary. I swung one of my cameras onto my chest, the other onto my back, ducked my head and shoulders, and waddled down the corridor, hunched and flat-footed like a duck. Rudolph, who was carrying even more equipment, followed behind. I repeatedly shone my flashlight on the smoothly polished white Tura limestone walls. What superior craftsmanship! The joints between the stones are barely noticeable and follow the angle of descent rather than running horizontally. The angle of inclination is 26 degrees, 31 minutes, 23 seconds. We were panting quietly. After about 40 meters, we took a break. My hair was caked to my forehead. On we waddled, duck style. After about 65 meters, we came upon a recess in the wall on the right-hand side. Fresh air was blowing through an ancient pipe, thousands of years old. On and on we went. Would this corridor never end? My thighs were throbbing. My tendons were unaccustomed to such exercise. 80 meters, 90 meters. We could not see any more lights below. We both knew that the corridor ends in a vault, but neither of us was aware of the length of the passageway. After another 28 meters, I felt raw dirt under my shoes. The air was sticky, warm. We were finally able to stand. A spotlight was lying on the ground, gutted wires hanging frazzled from its torn cable. With trembling hands, in the beam of my flashlight, Rudolph tied the ends of the cable back together, anxious to avoid short-circuiting the lamp or being electrocuted himself. The light came on. The vault in which we were standing was about 35 meters below the pyramid's foundation. Ancient Arabian sources tell us that the first person to enter the vault was Caliph Abdullah al-Ma'mun, the son of the famous Harun al-Rashid, a character in the Arabian Nights. Al-Ma'mun descended to the throne of Baghdad in 813 AD and also ruled Egypt from 820 until his death in 827. The young caliph was considered an intelligent man who supported the sciences and was aiming to improve the status of Arabia in the world. Ancient documents reported that 30 secret treasure vaults were located under the Great Pyramid. The vaults were said to contain the divine ancestors' precise land and sky maps. No wonder Al-Ma'mun was interested in these treasures, and since he was the ruler of Egypt, no one could blame him. Besides, the Muslim priests considered the pyramids heathen structures and had no objections to their desecration. How to crack a pyramid. Al-Ma'mun formed a crew of craftsmen, workers, and architects to find a way into the pyramid. But no number of crowbars or chisels could move even a single stone from the pyramid wall. Finally, Al-Ma'mun's men remembered an ancient warfare technique used to break up walls. They lit a big fire directly in front of one of the pyramid blocks and fanned the fire until the stone was searingly hot. Then they poured vinegar onto the rock. It cracked and finally could be smashed with battering rams. In this way, Al-Ma'mun's crew created the entrance which is still used today by tourists. With great effort, the men forced their way about 30 meters into the pyramid before the air became too thin, sticky, and poisonous, because the fire and the torches were consuming all the oxygen. The men were discouraged, ready to report to their master that they had failed. Suddenly, they stopped. Inside the pyramid, they could hear a dark rumbling sound, then a loud crash. They had to be close to a passageway. Somewhere inside the pyramid, a stone had tumbled down. Encouraged, the men continued their drilling, hammering, hoisting, and chiseling, and finally reached the descending corridor, which Rudolph and I had just waddled down. Initially, Al-Ma'mun's men were not interested in the descending portion of the passageway. Instead, they crawled upward until they reached the actual secret entrance to the Great Pyramid, situated 16.5 meters above ground level. 10 layers of rock higher than the hole Al-Ma'mun's men had opened up. After some pep talks and prayers to Allah, the men followed the dark corridor down to the spacious vault in which Rudolph and I were now standing. The spotlight fell on the ceiling, which was hewn out of the solid rock. It wandered over to the walls and illuminated 2 monolithic pedestals of gigantic proportions. 2 curious, unfinished bulges protruded from the monstrous rocks. On the floor behind us, we discovered a rough-edged shaft about 4 meters deep, surrounded by an iron guardrail. In the southwest wall to its left was an opening identical to the size of the corridor through which we had just passed. Very adept at duck waddling by now, we crawled into the passageway, anxious to discover what other chambers the tunnel might lead to. After about 15 meters, the corridor ended abruptly. A dead end down here? What for? The underground room that has been chiseled out of the rock below the pyramid measures 14.02 meters in an east-west direction and 8.25 meters from north to south. Those are respectable dimensions. Modern archaeologists call it an unfinished burial vault, and thus plunge us into a hurricane of absurdities. Contradictions. The pseudo-sepulchre is supposed to be unfinished. Let us think this through in detail. It is unlikely that the cave was created after the pyramid had already been erected. How would they have disposed of the waste materials? It is safe to assume, then, that the subterranean structures were completed before the top of the pyramid was added on. How did the masons get down to 35 meters below ground? Through digging and chiseling, of course. Like a mole, the first worker in line must have broken fragments out of the rock with soft copper and iron chisels and moved them down the line to his colleagues behind him, who transported the rubble up to the entrance. The deeper the tunnel descended underground, the darker it got, right? They needed torches, wax, oil lamps. There goes the last breath of oxygen. Obviously, this scenario is out of the question. The builders must have used air shafts, as we know them from later mining operations. But where are they? Today, we know of one shaft running across the descending corridor, and we are told that it was created by grave robbers. Never mind. Let us presume that the human moles, some way or other, reached the point at which they planned to build the underground sepulcher. Now they continued as suggested above. Let's get out the hammers and chisels, friends. Who needs light and air down here? Maybe the crews worked in the dark, with radar, X-ray, or albino vision, and did not give a hoot if a piece of rock crushed someone's head, pinched some fingers, or squashed some feet now and then. The rubble was hauled up to the surface with sleds. Air was probably filtered into the dusty vault through hoses made of animal intestines. My sarcastic description is intended to demonstrate how it certainly was not done. Undoubtedly, there must be air shafts leading to this subterranean chamber under the pyramid. Archaeologists, light your lanterns and knock on all the walls and ceilings. Maybe you will be fortunate enough to find one of the treasure vaults described in ancient tales. After the cave was half done, the merry workers must have dug a 15-meter-long dead-end tunnel in the southwest corner, just for the fun of it, and lined it with nicely polished stones. To top it off, they dug a hole in the ground, abandoned the cavernous vault, and, picture this, began to line the corridor, which they had broken so painfully out of the rock, with massive, smoothly polished Tura stones. Over 100 meters, straight as an arrow, pointing upward without the slightest angle deviation. And why did they go through all this trouble, labor, and blood-spitting effort in a narrow dungeon? To create an unfinished hole in the rock, 35 meters below ground, which was never going to store anything anyway. Some people live so cautiously that they die practically brand new. Others use their brains exclusively for reading, never for thinking. I am told that a different architect or builder took over during the construction of the pyramid, and that the plans were changed on short notice. I beg your pardon? As long as stones were hammered out of the rock in the unfinished burial vault below, and as long as rubble needed to be transported up to the surface, the descending 100-meter shaft could not be lined with polished Tura stones. Even with no more than 10 meters of the Tura stones in place, it would have been impossible to dispose of the waste materials from the cave below. There simply was no room. I know, because I crawled down there. Moreover, the rubble would have scratched the perfectly polished walls. There were no scratches, and neither are there any indications that wheels or dragging devices were used. If we follow the archaeologist's interpretation that the cavernous hole is an unfinished burial vault, a cave which suddenly lost its purpose and became superfluous in the plans of a new builder, there would be no reason to line the 118-meter-long access corridor to this useless sepulcher with polished Tura monoliths. After all, the polished stones could not be installed until after excavation on the subterranean chamber was complete. A royal entrance to an unfinished dirt hole below the pyramid? A dead-end tunnel issuing from the same chamber? What's wrong with this picture? I see three possibilities. 1. The chamber is continued somehow, behind a monolith maybe. 2. The vault has already been plundered. 3. Someone was put to rest in the sepulchre, maybe in a hibernating state. This unknown person did not care about earthly names, inscriptions, or praises, or about a chamber filled with monoliths. He was interested in the preservation of his body and nothing else. The body had to survive a certain amount of time without decay. There was no need for decorations and gewgaws. Perhaps all three of these possibilities are somehow intertwined. What did Al-Mamun's brave intruders find inside the unfinished burial vault? What did they, the first ones to enter it in several thousand years, find inside the Great Pyramid? The Arabs' exciting discoveries. Nobody knows anything specific. There are no written inventories, or if there were, they have been lost. In the 14th century, libraries in Cairo still had old Arabic and Coptic manuscripts and fragments, which the geographer and historian Taqi ad-Din Ahmed ben Ali ben Abdel al-Qadir ben Mahmoud al-Mukrazi compiled in his opus Hittat. The quotes from this book are worth savoring. While some passages may remind us of the flowery Arabic expressions of the Arabian Nights, they also contain a substantial amount of names, dates, traditions, and other amazing information. The Hittat states that the three great pyramids were built under a favorable constellation that had been agreed upon. After that, the builder had 30 treasure vaults made from colored granite in the Western Pyramid. They were filled with rich treasures, with tools and steel made from precious stones, with tools made from excellent iron, like weapons that will not rust, with glass that can be folded without breaking, with strange talismans, with the various kinds of simple and combined healing potions, and with deadly venoms. In the Eastern Pyramid, he created representations of the various constellations and the planets, as well as pictures of the things his ancestors had created. Added to that were incense sacrificed to the stars and books about the stars. One also finds there the fixed stars and that which happens in their eras from time to time. Finally, he had the corpses of the prophets brought to the colored pyramid in coffins made from black granite. Next to each prophet was a book which described his marvelous skills, his life, and his works that he had accomplished in his time, and there was no science that he did not have written down and recorded. In addition, he had the treasures of the constellations brought there, which had been offered to them as gifts, as well as the prophet's treasures, and they made up a huge and innumerable amount. Furthermore, we are told that the king had an idol placed under each pyramid to fight off possible intruders with different weapons. One of these guards was standing upright and had some kind of spear with him. A snake was curled around his body, which would attack anyone approaching the guard. Another guard is described as having wide-open, flashing eyes and is sitting on a throne, also carrying a spear. Those who saw him were unable to move and stood there immobilized until they died. The third pyramid was protected by a guard who grabbed intruders and pulled them close until they stuck to him and could not get away and finally died. When the builder of the pyramids died, he was buried inside one of the pyramids. Arabic traditions hold that all three pyramids contained treasures and books with unbelievable contents. Did Al-Mamun plunder the treasure vaults? Did he find mummies in sarcophaguses? Al-Mamun opened the Great Pyramid. I entered the inside and saw a large vaulted chamber with a rectangular base, but round at the top. In its center was a rectangular well, 10 yards deep. If one descends down the well, one finds a door on all four sides, which leads to a large room in which corpses are laid out, sons of Adam. It is reported that people climbed up here in Al-Mamun's time and reached a vaulted chamber of small size, in which stood the statue of a man made from green stone, a kind of malachite. It was taken before Al-Mamun, and discovered that it was closed off with a lid. When it was opened, one saw inside the corpse of a man wearing a golden coat of armor embellished with all kinds of precious stones. On his chest lay the blade of a sword, without handle, and next to his head a red hyacinth stone the size of a chicken egg, which glowed like the flame of a fire. Al-Mamun took the stone. But I saw the statue out of which the corpse was taken, next to the gates of the royal palace in Misr, Cairo, in the year 511. They now entered the middle chamber and found three burrs made of transparent glowing stones. On them were three corpses. Each was covered with three robes and had next to his head a book written in an unknown language. Al-Mamun ordered that everything that had been found in the vaults be removed. Then, at his command, the figures on the columns were pulled down again, and the gates closed like before. We are tempted to discard this account as being a little oriental, too sappy to be true. But what gives us the right to judge solely from our present viewpoint and to regard ancient reports as unreliable? Were any of us there? Did any of us know the chroniclers, who in their time were honorable and well-respected men? We see ourselves as a society with electronic mass communication, the best-informed society of all time. But every piece of information which scientists, students, journalists, the media, and ordinary people receive has already been screened, filtered, and partly distorted. The opinion we form about an issue is often no more than someone else's regurgitated opinion, and that opinion, in turn, was formed on the basis of biased information. Generalizations like, "Arabian chroniclers are giving us fairy tales," or, "We know everything there is to know about the pyramids," or, "The proven scientific opinion," are phrases which expose our lack of knowledge. We have become myopic. Probably because the flood of information with which we are inundated forces us to screen out certain ideas. All too often we think we know something. The Arabian historians tell us that Al-Mamun found the corpse of a man wearing a strange coat of armor decorated with precious stones. Is it a fairy tale? We know such armor from the Old Testament, the second book of Moses, Exodus chapter 28. Details the garments which Aaron, Moses' brother, and the Levite priests were told to wear, specifically, among other things, a breastplate with 12 different precious stones. New corridors and chambers. There are supposed to be statues, sarcophaguses, and books with scientific information in the three great pyramids. Derivations of an overactive imagination? Doesn't science know all there is to know about the pyramids already? Gullible minds may think so. The radiation experiment conducted on the Khafre Pyramid in late 1968 and early 1969 by Nobel Prize-winning physicist Dr. Luis Alvarez is well known. Alvarez and his team base their studies on the fact that cosmic rays bombard our planet 24 hours a day, and that they lose some of their energy as they penetrate solid matter, such as rock. On the average, a square meter of soil is flooded with 10,000 protons per second. The most highly energized of those cosmic particles can penetrate even the thickest layers of rock. Others can pass through the entire planet. The number of elementary particles entering a rock formation can be measured with instruments. If the rock contains any hollow spaces, the protons slow down less in passing through the hollow space. Thus, the flow of protons is greater than in solid rock. A stark chamber was installed inside the Khafre Pyramid so that the rays of the cosmic particles could be recorded on magnetic tape. These tapes were then analyzed by an IBM computer, taking into account the shape of the pyramid, its size, and its angle of inclination. By the end of 1968, the orbits of over 2.5 million cosmic rays had been registered. The computer analysis showed the shape of the pyramid correctly. The scientists knew that the experiment was reasonable and the instruments were working properly. Then came the big surprise that left the scientists aghast. The oscilloscopes recorded a chaotic pattern. There was no discernible order anymore. If the same magnetic tape were run through the computer twice, it came up with different data and charts each time. It was incredibly frustrating. The experiment, which was very expensive and was funded by various American institutions, IBM and An Shams University of Cairo, yielded no measurable results. Dr. Amir Gohet explained to journalists that the findings were scientifically impossible, and he added that either the structure of the pyramid is a mess, or there is some kind of mystery which we cannot explain, whether one calls it the occult, the curse of the pharaohs, or magic. Other scientists have searched for rooms inside the pyramid since then, with new devices and new methods, and they have been successful. In the summer of 1986, two French architects, Jean-Patrice Dormont and Gilles Goyden, located hollow spaces inside the Great Pyramid with the help of electronic detectors. In cooperation with the Egyptian Department of Antiquities, they sent microprobes through 2.5 meters of rock. Below the corridor leading to the Queen's Chamber, the French scientists found another chamber, about 3 meters wide and 5.5 meters high, filled with crystalline silica. Another hollow space was located behind the northwest wall of the Queen's Chamber. So far, no entrances to these chambers have been discovered. So, what do we know? How can we dismiss Arabian traditions as fairy tales? Alarmed by the success of the French team, the Japanese researchers at Waseda University in Tokyo stepped up their efforts. They had already tested a kind of radar device which could practically X-ray various rock formations, granite, limestone, sandstone. The top-notch crew from Waseda University arrived on January 22, 1987, in Cairo. It included a professor of Egyptology, a professor of architecture, a doctor of geophysics, and various electronics engineers. The leader of the team was Professor Sakuji Yashimura, who established close professional cooperation with Dr. Ahmed Kadri, the director of the Egyptian Department of Antiquities. The Japanese, always brilliant in the electronics sector and equipped with superb mobile instruments and computers, X-rayed the corridor leading to the Queen's Chamber, the Queen's Chamber itself, the King's Chamber above, the entire area south of the Great Pyramid, and finally the Sphinx and its surroundings. What did they find? I will make it brief. The Japanese researchers discovered unmistakable evidence that there is an entire labyrinth of corridors and chambers lurking inside the Great Pyramid. The colorfully illustrated scientific report of the Waseda University team presents 60 pages of actual measurements taken at the individual sectors, and they are full of white bars, corridors, shafts, and empty spaces inside the pyramid. Southwest of the King's Chamber and southwest of the main axes of the Grand Gallery, fairly large vaults were located. A corridor originates at the northwest wall of the Queen's Chamber, and a 42-meter-long pit was found south of the Great Pyramid that seems to extend below the pyramid. The electronic devices of the Japanese also indicated the existence of a second sunbark in the rock below the pyramid, and this finding has been confirmed since then. Now what? What other surprises are in store for us? How do those all-knowing scientists who had dismissed the possibility of undiscovered chambers in the pyramid feel now? At present, no one knows what is inside those electronically detected vaults and corridors, or whether they have been plundered already. No one? As I told you before, the Grand Gallery and the Queen's Chamber were stuffed with scaffolding and boards in December 1988. There was not a construction worker in sight. My question is, did additional electronic tests and drillings take place in the dark of the night? Were microprobes with glass fibers inserted through the pyramid stones to photograph the inside of the pyramid? I could understand such procedures. It is impossible to do any kind of scientific study amidst the tourist buzz. On the other hand, wouldn't it be detrimental to the reputation of the field of Egyptology if researchers opened these chambers, hidden for thousands of years, like thieves in the night, without informing the public? Who would believe after the fact that the artifacts presented or not presented were all that was found? The Khufu hoax. Maybe we are in for a surprise of a different sort in the Great Pyramid, one that would be particularly painful to Egyptologists, namely the fact that Khufu was not the builder of the Great Pyramid. Whenever I ask one of the experts who the builder of the Great Pyramid was, I get the same immediate stereotypical answer: Khufu. No doubt? No doubt. Pharaoh Khufu is a proven scientific fact. It is inappropriate to question it, and that's that. But if we dig a little deeper below the surface, this proven scientific fact is in for a rude awakening. What evidence bestowed the halo of the pyramid builder on Pharaoh Khufu? Where does this absolute certainty come from that no one but Khufu could have built this most impressive edifice? Remember that there are no texts in the Great Pyramid praising or glorifying the builder. It is anonymous vanity. Under closer scrutiny, we find that there are only two indications that point to Khufu, but scientific literature has blown these two out of proportion. Herodotus wrote that the pyramid was commissioned by Cheops. Cheops is Greek for the Egyptian Khufu. Diodorus Siculus lists Chemos as the builder of the pyramid. But Gaius Plinius Secundus, who enumerates the names of the historians who described the pyramid before him, notes wryly that none of them really knew who the builders were. In this particular case, archaeologists rely exclusively on Herodotus, while discounting his statements everywhere else. The second piece of evidence pointing to Cheops or Khufu is an inscription in one of the corbelled vaults above the king's chamber. Whoa! Didn't I claim repeatedly that there are no inscriptions inside the Great Pyramid? It is a mystery, or actually a crime, perpetrated by an impostor. The case was not solved by Sherlock Holmes, but by Zakaria Sitchin, a specialist in old Oriental languages. On December 29, 1835, Colonel Howard Wisey, a British officer of the Guards, arrived in Egypt. Wisey was a sardonic gentleman, a grandson of the Earl of Stafford, on the one hand disciplined to the bone, on the other, the black sheep of the family who had to work extra hard to prove himself. Wisey was thrilled and fascinated by the mystery of the pyramids. He immediately hooked up with the Italian captain Giovanni Battista Caviglio, who had been digging in Giza for quite some time. But over the course of the next few months, the two men had a falling out, and they parted company on February 13, 1837. Wisey, the Briton, who had received a license to excavate from the British consul, chased the Italian off. 72 years prior to Howard Wisey, the British diplomat Nathaniel Davison had discovered a hole in the ceiling at the end of the Grand Gallery. On July 8, 1765, he crawled inside. Davison progressed to the lowest one of the corbelled vaults above the King's Chamber. Howard Wisey, of course, was aware of Davison's discovery. He noted in his diary that he suspected the existence of a sepulchre hidden above the Davison chamber. Wisey was determined to become famous. He wanted his name to go down in history. He felt he owed that much to his family. On January 27, 1837, he wrote in his diary that he had to discover something before returning to England. Wisey and his chief engineer, John S. Paring, procured some gunpowder and blew a tunnel into the rock above the Davison Chamber. Indeed, on March 30th, April 27th, May 6th, and May 27th, 1837, Wisey and Paring discovered four additional chambers above the Davison Chamber, which they named the Wellington, Nelson, Arbuthnot, and Campbell Chambers in that order. In the upper two rooms, Wisey noticed some signs on the monoliths which apparently had been painted with red paint. It was known that builders often marked individual monoliths from the quarries of the Wadi Mughara Mountains with paint so that there would be no mix-up and they would reach their proper destinations. One of the paint marks displayed the pharaoh name Khufu. It was the proof that was needed. The painted monolith was shipped to Khufu Cheops. The sensational news spread around the globe. Howard Wisey had accomplished his goal. No one seemed to mind that the Khufu insignia, which should have been found all over the place, considering that more than 2 million stones were used in the Great Pyramid alone, were not found anywhere else. In a fascinating book and in two articles in Ancient Skies, the American Orient expert Zakaria Sitchin exposed Wisey as a fraud. The evidence against Howard Wisey is such an ingenious criminological masterpiece that it is difficult to understand how Egyptologists can continue to defend their erroneous, proven scientific fact. Zakaria Sitchin unmasks the Wisey-Paring hoax with the help of dates, quotes, and excerpts from Wisey's diary, and in particular because of an orthographic mistake committed by the forger. Shortly after the Khufu paint marks were discovered, some experts voiced doubts about its authenticity, but their words of caution were drowned out by the prevailing euphoria. Samuel Birch, an Egyptologist and expert in hieroglyphics, cautioned in 1837, although the symbol is not very legible because it is written in semi-hieratic or linear hieroglyphic letters, and a little later, the meaning is not entirely clear, very difficult to interpret. What caused such confusion for the hieroglyphics expert? The painted marks used symbols which did not even exist in Khufu's time. Over the centuries, the picture symbols of ancient Egypt turned into a hieratic language long after Khufu. Even Richard Lepsius, the presumed discoverer of the labyrinth, wondered about the brush-painted red symbols because they resembled the hieratic language. How did the symbols end up inside the Great Pyramid? Did anyone enter the pyramid many centuries after its completion to paint the symbols on the monoliths? No way. The corbelled vaults were completely inaccessible. Wisey had been forced to use gunpowder. Wisey, a military man, not an Egyptologist, knew only one standard book about hieroglyphs, the textbook Materia Hieroglyphica by John Gardner Wilkinson, published in 1828. It was discovered later that the name Khufu is misspelled in Wilkinson's textbook. The constant KH was mistakenly shown as the sun symbol Re. The impostors Wisey and Paring not only used a language which did not develop until many centuries after Khufu, they also copied the orthographic mistake from Wilkinson's textbook. Didn't anyone realize that the red paint was fresh? Zakaria Sitchin commented that this question was answered at the time by one of the principals, namely Paring, in his own work about the pyramids of Giza. Paring wrote that the paint that was used for the ancient Egyptian inscriptions was a compound of red ochre, which the Arabs called magra, and which is still in use. The drawings were preserved so well on the stones that one could not possibly tell if they had been done the day before or 3,000 years earlier. I asked several Egyptologists about the discoveries Zakaria Sitchin had made. None of them were familiar with his analysis. They assume that they know the truth, and comfort themselves with the assurance that Howard Wiese was an honorable archaeologist. Wiese was not an archaeologist. He may have been honorable in certain ways, but he also was a glory hunter. Honor is a dubious quality, even in archaeology. The British archaeologist Howard Carter gained world fame on November 4, 1922, when he discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun. No one dared question his side of the story. His reputation was beyond reproach. Carter maintained that, unfortunately, the anterooms of the actual tomb had already been opened by grave robbers. Today, we know that Carter was lying through his teeth. He was the one who entered Tutankhamun's vault before the official opening of the tomb, turned everything upside down, and stole a number of valuable objects so that he did not have to share them 50-50 with the Egyptian government, as his contract demanded. This crime was exposed by Dr. Rolf Krauss, an archaeologist at the Egyptian Museum in Berlin, yet neither the experts nor the public reacted to Krauss's discovery. Who was the builder? There is not a shred of convincing proof that Khufu was indeed the builder of the Great Pyramid. This does not invalidate the possibility that he may have built the pyramid, but there is more evidence against him than for him. There are no hieroglyphs, pyramid texts, statues, busts, walls full of praises. A single tiny 5-centimeter-high figurine made of ivory and displayed in the Antiquities Museum is supposed to represent Khufu. On the other hand, there is evidence solid as a rock against Khufu. Yet, the experts ignore it. In 1850, a stele was found among the ruins of the Isis Temple, which is now exhibited in the Egyptian Antiquities Museum in Cairo. The Isis Temple was located directly adjacent to the Great Pyramid. The inscription on the stele states that Khufu founded the House of Isis, the goddess of the pyramid, next to the House of the Sphinx. Since Isis is mentioned as the goddess of the pyramid, it is clear that the Great Pyramid was already in existence at the time of Khufu. Moreover, the Sphinx is said to have existed as well, although archaeologists claim that it was built by Khufu's successor, Khafre. Why do scientists ignore this explosive, set-in-stone message? The stele was found in 1850. Remember, 13 years earlier, it had been determined that Khufu was the builder of the Great Pyramid, thanks to Howard Wiese's fraudulent discoveries. The stele did not fit the scientists' models. Archaeologists declared it a fake and claimed that it was created after Khufu's death to support the ideas of the local priests. All of these elements justify my question. If Khufu was not the builder of the world wonder of Giza, then who was? Egyptologists have complete chronological accounts of all the pharaohs after Khufu. There is no room for an additional pharaoh after Khufu. If it could not have been a pharaoh after Khufu, then it must have been one before Khufu. The very thought is unbearable to archaeologists. It would completely upset their treasured chronology of construction events. Can Arabian historians help us out? What does Al Makrazi have to say? The largest pyramids are those which are across from Misr to the present day. People cannot agree on the time of their construction, the name of their builder, or the reason for their construction, and have expressed various opinions, most of which are wrong. I now want to relate that which satisfies and suffices if God, the Almighty, allows me to. The teacher Ibrahim ben Wasif Sal al-Khatib states in his News of Egypt and its Wonders, in the place where he tells of Sarid, the son of Saluk, the son of Serbak, the son of Tumadin, the son of Tarasan, the son of Husal, one of the kings of Egypt prior to the Great Flood, who resided in the city of Amsus, which is discussed in the part of the book which deals with Egypt's cities. He was the builder of the two great pyramids near Misr. The reason for the construction of the two pyramids was that 300 years before the Great Flood, Sarid had the following dream. The earth turned upside down with all its people. The people fled in a blind rush, and the stars fell down. Considering the precise list of names, I find it difficult to discard the text as a fairy tale or myth. According to the description, a king named Sarid had a dream 300 years before the Great Flood, which eventually led to the construction of the pyramid. His advisors and prophets were also plagued by horrible dreams. They predicted the end of civilization. The sky opened up, a bright light emerged, and men descended from heaven who carried iron clubs in their hands, which they used to bludgeon people. Older than the Flood. The king asked his wise men if people would be able to live again in Egypt after the flood. Their answer was affirmative. He decided to build the pyramids so that all the human knowledge of the time would be preserved, an excellent reason. At the top of the pyramid, the antediluvian king Sarid had the following message inscribed. I, Sarid, the king, have built the pyramids at this time and have completed their construction in 6 years. Those who come after me and believe that they are kings like me should try to destroy it in 600 years, and it is known that it is easier to destroy than to build. When they were finished, I had them covered with brocade. May they cover them with mats. When King Sarid ben Saluk died, he was buried in the eastern pyramid. Hugib, however, in the western one. And Karurus in the pyramid that is made on the bottom with stones from Aswan, and at the top with Kadan stones. These pyramids have gates below the ground which lead into a vaulted corridor. Each corridor measures 150 yards. The gate to the eastern pyramid is on the north side, the gate of the western pyramid is on the west side, and the gate to the vaulted corridor of the stone-covered pyramid is on the south side. The pyramids contain unimaginable treasures of gold and emeralds. The man who translated this text from the Coptic language into Arabic added the dates up to the sunrise of the first day of Toth, it was a Sunday, in the year 225 of the Arabian calendar, and came up with 4,321 solar years. When he examined how much time had passed after the flood up to that particular day, the result was 1,741 years, 59 days, 13 and 4/5 hours, and 59/400 hours. He subtracted this from the previous sum and was left with 399 years, 205 days, 10 hours, and 21/400 hours. He then realized that this text was written so many years, days, hours, and partial hours before the flood. The Hittat lists several Arabian sources, one after another, which contradict each other as to the construction date of the pyramid. The following is only one example. Abu Said al-Balhi states, on the pyramids was an inscription written in their language. It was understood, and it read, these two pyramids were built when the falling vulture was in the Tropic of Cancer. So they calculated from this point to the Hegira of the Prophet and came up with 2 times 36,000 solar years. Who was this provident King Sarid? Is he a mythical fantasy figure invented in a dream world of wishes and desires, or can he be realistically placed? The Hittat states that he was Hermes, whom the Arabs call Idris. It is said that he was personally instructed by God in the science of the stars, and that God told him that a catastrophe would befall the earth, but that a part of it would survive and would have a need for scientific knowledge. Consequently, Hermes, a.k.a. Idris, a.k.a. Sarid, had the pyramids built. The Hittat is even more specific. There are people who say the first Hermes, who was called the Triune because of his function as prophet, king, and wise man, he is the one whom the Hebrews call Enoch, the son of Jared, the son of Mahal-Alil, the son of Ka-Enon, the son of Enos, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, blessed be his soul, and that is Idris, read in the stars that the flood was about to come. So he had the pyramids built and had hidden inside of them treasures, learned writings, and all those things which he feared might get lost or disappear, so that they would be protected and well preserved. People in the West are not used to thinking in dimensions preceding the Great Flood, and so we ask in our confusion why the Arabian historians insist on dating the pyramids to a time before the Flood. Muhammad ben Abdullah ben Abdul al-Hakam submits an excellent argument. In my opinion, the pyramids can only have been built before the Flood. If they had been built after, people would know more about them. A very good argument indeed. Irrefutable. The statement in the Hittat that Enoch in the Old Testament is identical with Hermes and Idris is very exciting. Much can be derived from it. Enoch, a.k.a. Hermes, a.k.a. Idris, a.k.a. the Hittat, is not the only source to identify Sarid as the builder of the pyramids. Ibn Battuta, a 14th-century Arabian explorer and writer, also assures us that Enoch had the pyramids built before the flood to preserve in them books about science and knowledge and other valuable objects. My friend Enoch. Who is this Enoch? My faithful readers know him from my earlier work, thus I will keep my description short. In Hebrew, the name Enoch means the consecrated one, the judicious one, the knowing one. Moses calls him the seventh of the 10 forefathers, an antediluvian patriarch who has been overshadowed by his son Methuselah for thousands of years. The book of Genesis tells us that Methuselah lived to be 969 years old, hence the expression, as old as Methuselah. The Old Testament mentions Enoch only briefly, although he does not deserve to be shortchanged in such a way. Enoch is the author of several exciting first-person narratives. The books of Enoch are not part of the Old Testament. The church leaders did not understand Enoch, and therefore precluded him from public viewing. Fortunately, the Ethiopian church did not follow these orders. Enoch's writings were included in the Old Testament canon of the Abyssinian church and have been in its register of holy scriptures ever since. At present, two versions of Enoch's books exist, which are essentially similar, the Ethiopian and the Slavic Enoch books. Highly academic text comparisons prove that they are based on the same original, written by a single author. Those who attempt to interpret Enoch's writings from a stubbornly theological viewpoint encounter a maze of curious statements. However, if we strip the text of its ornamental embellishments and flowery symbolism, we are left with an incredibly dramatic skeleton narrative without changing its meaning one bit. The first five chapters of the book of Enoch announce a world judgment. Chapters 17 through 36 describe Enoch's travels to different worlds and distant constellations. Chapter 37 through 71 contain various kinds of parables which the heavenly beings related to the prophet. Chapters 72 through 82 report in exact detail information about solar and lunar orbits, leap days, stars, and universal occurrences. The remaining chapters record conversations between Enoch and his son Methuselah, whom Enoch warns of the coming flood.